Hi, I'm NASA astronaut Rick Mastracchio, University of Connecticut graduate. I'm currently orbiting 260 miles above Earth on board the International Space Station. I've been here about 6 months, and I'm scheduled to land in Kazakhstan around May 13th. I could not be there with you on this big day, but I wanted to pass on my congratulations to the 2014 School of Engineering graduating class.
Astronaut Rick Mastracchio giving this year's commencement speech for the University of Connecticut School of Engineering. We're going to talk about college commencement speeches and space later on in the show. But first, fire season, as Cherry said, is upon us. Santa Ana winds, high heat, low humidity mean high fire danger in all of Southern California. Brush fires in San Diego and Santa Barbara led to thousands of evacuations yesterday. People there have returned to their homes, but temperatures are even hotter today all over. So what are we doing about it here? Drew Smith is a captain with the Los Angeles County Fire Department. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Well, tell us, how bad are the conditions right now out there?
Well, the conditions are very prominent for a high-risk fire day. So the fire danger that we have on this, which is very odd or a rare event for this time in May, really heightens our fire danger awareness.
And I suppose the drought makes everything worse?
That is correct. When we the vegetation is very reflective of moisture and soil moisture contents, and so when we are in a rainfall deficit, the vegetation does react to that.
In all your years with the fire department, how does this rate?
Well, last year we had similar conditions, and we did have a significant fire in Ventura County and also impacted Los Angeles County, which was a Springs fire that burned in excess of 24,000 acres. So when we target these abnormally dry weather events with high winds, it really does give us a large potential for large fire growth.
And most fires, 9 out of 10, are started by human activity. Is there any way then to predict where the bad ones will begin?
Well, with this time of, we really have a year-round fire season in Southern California. Our traditional fire season starts around June and then ends somewhere around Christmas, because that's when we target our hotter, drier weather. Our live fuel moisture contents have dried up because of the precipitation that it receives in late November through April, so those soil moistures dry up. So when we're in a drought type of year, like scenario like we are here, when we have a deficit of only 70% of normal, those fuels stay drier than normal. And when you give that abnormally warm temperatures, low relative humidity, and then you put wind speeds in excess of 15 to 25 miles an hour, that really ripens that fuel bed to promote large fire growth. So we look at areas within Southern California, and the different fire agencies look at their targeted areas to where they're vulnerable. And vulnerability is with the older growth vegetation that has a lot of decadent brush in it because it hasn't had fire frequency in some years.
And where is that?
Well, it's throughout all of Southern California, and we can tell by, if we look at our fire history maps, we can see where our areas of vulnerability are because of our older growth vegetation, those mature chaparral stands. We're up in the upper elevations in the mixed conifer and the pine trees, if you will, really don't share that same vulnerability with that like we do in our brush fuels.
And are you right now at a fire camp?
No, I'm actually at our headquarters location in East Los Angeles right now.
But you work up in the hills in the fire camps?
That is correct. Los Angeles County Fire Department has 9 fire camps, 5 which are inmate camps and 4 which are paid camps. Those are our hand crews that we roster every day, 365 days a year, and we put 28 Type 1 hand crews on duty every day.
You have 5 inmate camps?
Yes.
And so these are prisoners?
That is correct. They're low risk felons, if you will, and they we share custody with them with the California Department of Corrections, which they do the custody basically after work hours, and we have them from 0800 to 1600 ish at in the afternoon, and
so
we
4
go out
p.m.
and
in the
work.
Afternoon, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And then they go back to their cells.
Well, they don't have cells. They're actually it's a working camp. So it's think about prison without bars is what they have. So it's a camp type setting that has dormitories that they go back and they go to their different dorms and they sleep and they're under the custody of California Department of Corrections.
I see. So I don't know. Are prison guards standing there with guns as they're putting
no,
out
they,
fires?
No, they don't do that because they're low risk and their convictions are of minor impact to being a threat to civilians and fire personnel. So it's a great workforce for our organization and throughout the state of California, which also has a cooperative agreement with that with California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection as well, which is CAL FIRE. So within the state of California, we have a significant workforce for hand crews, which involves inmate labor.
And what exactly are they doing at these fire camps?
They cut fire lines, so they are responsible for working under the supervision of a fire crew supervisor and captain and battalion chiefs that they will go out and perform fire line or hand line construction. So they are actually on the front line of combating these fires with the use of hand tools and cutting fire line and fuel breaks.
So are they in danger? Is it a very dangerous job?
They share the same risk as your paid full-time firefighters do. So they share that same risk for being in a very hazardous situation.
And they don't get paid, I assume?
They do not get professionally paid. No, it is part of a working agreement with their sentencing, and every individual that's incarcerated has a different stipulation under which they work under. But they have to qualify to be in a camp-type setting. So they have to be in very good shape. We hike and work our crews. We have a high work ethic with our organization and also CAL FIRE. So to be on that hand crew or on that inmate hand crew, you have to have a very strong physical standard.
So there are different agencies fighting fires at any one time. There's the city, there's the county, there's the state. How do all these agencies interact, and how do they work together?
We actually interact very well. We have Master Mutual Aid, which we work under. We have common terminology, common radio frequencies, and within the state of California, the firefighting agencies are very robust. So with that, we're able to, through Office of Emergency Services, or CALEMA as it's called, we are able to assemble through working agreements to get resources to help and other organizations with their fires, whether it be CAL FIRE or any of the federal agencies that has a fire on their land. We can go assist through a Master Mutual Aid agreement.
Well, given the fact that this promises to be a very heavy fire season, how do you feel about the level of staffing and the level of funding?
Well, funding I can't comment on because that's not where I work in that level to determine funding. However, I can talk to staffing. Staffing is what we look at is for our organization and also the state agencies and other local government. We look at what fire history has told us and also climatology. So we have a response matrix that we'll look at, if you will, that will look at current weather conditions and also look at fuel conditions. And we can target through fire history, and we can also target with current climatology to see when and where we're vulnerable to promote large fire growth. So we go into augmented staffing modes to where we will hire extra firefighters, we will put extra engine companies, hand crews, and helicopters on duty to have a very strong initial attack response to keep the fires as small as possible.
But do you think you have enough people to fight the fires?
Yes. And the Southern California agencies are staffed very well. However, when Mother Nature is stronger than what the workforce is, one thing that it's very hard to do is combat these fires when you're giving fuel and weather conditions that may outperform what the firefighting capabilities are. Sometimes the fires are large enough, they move so fast, it is very hard for us to control or contain until something transitions.
Well, we're in a drought and our mm-hmm. reservoirs are low, and do you think we have enough water to fight these fires?
We do. Yeah, we do. Yeah. The fire agencies, the way that we work our hydrant systems, the way that we have our dip sites for our aircraft, we have those strategically around the state, so we know what water resources we have. So for firefighting capabilities, we are well set.
All right. Well, let's hope you don't have to use them that much. Drew Smith, captain with the Los Angeles County Fire Department. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
Orange County has become the first major county in California to adopt what's known as Laura's Law. Supervisors voted unanimously for it. That means people suffering from mental illness who are a threat to the community can be forced into treatment by a court. The new law comes after Kelly Thomas, a homeless, mentally ill man, was killed 3 years ago by Fullerton police officers. But Laura's Law has been around for a dozen years. California state lawmakers approved it, but it's up to counties to fund it. And until yesterday, only one had, the small Nevada county near Lake Tahoe. So will Orange County lead the way for the rest of the state to adopt the law? And how effective are these kinds of laws in helping the severely mentally ill? We're going to ask these questions and more to Jeffrey Swanson. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University School of Medicine. He studies these types of laws around the country. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's nice to have you. Laura's Law was based on New York's Kendra's Law, which has been around for a long time. How similar are they?
The legal features of Kendra's Law and Laura's Law are almost identical. That is to say, they're a form of outpatient commitment where the state's authority to involuntarily commit people is extended into the community. So it's a form of mandated community treatment. And it's a preventive form, which is to say that this can be authorized for people who don't already meet criteria for involuntary hospitalization, but it's expected based on their history that they might deteriorate in the future without treatment, and without the supervision of this court order, they might not get that treatment. So it's 10 states have that particular form of outpatient commitment. 45 states have some form of outpatient commitment, such as conditional release or an alternative to hospitalization on the front end. That's to say, the legal part, but the part about it that is the treatment program and how that's organized and financed, that's quite different, as you've implied.
Right, right. Well, tell us, who would qualify for this court-ordered treatment?
Well, it's designed for people who have a serious mental disorder, such as schizophrenia, that impairs their ability to reason and to function in the community, who have a history of multiple hospitalizations or perhaps arrests that are connected to the fact that they don't get treatment and don't, for whatever reason, adhere to or comply with recommended psychiatric treatment. But they have to be able to be capable of surviving safely in the community with supports. But they have a current mental status that really limits their ability to voluntarily participate in treatment, and there's a need to prevent treatment to prevent deterioration. So they're basically not just everybody who's mentally ill, and not even people who have serious mental illnesses, but it's really designed for people who have this history of sort of revolving door hospitalizations, followed by a period where they don't participate in treatment, then a deterioration, and then in the aftermath of deinstitutionalization, there were people who had this pattern. This was designed as a way to try to help people like that get treatment.
Well, how do you force someone to take medication when they just don't want to, or they don't think they need to take it?
Well, it's important to clarify that outpatient commitment laws don't actually allow forcible medication in the outpatient setting, with maybe one exception. But in general, really what happens is that there's a kind of the leverage or the sanction, or what can happen if people don't follow the treatment plan, is that they can be picked up by law enforcement, transported to a treatment facility, and hopefully persuaded to stay in treatment and to take medicine, but and they're evaluated to see whether they would meet criteria for inpatient commitment. So if you think about it, there are two components here. There's the court order and there's the treatment plan. So it's kind of a treatment plan for intensive treatment, such as case management and treatment of medication, wrapped in a court order or a legal vessel, the treatment plan inside. The idea is it sort of commits the system to the person, as well as using the moral authority of the court to say to this person, you need to participate in treatment. But push comes to shove if people actually say, I don't want medicine, and they don't meet the strict involuntary commitment criteria to be put in the hospital, then it can't be forced.
Mm-hmm. And that involuntary commitment criteria involves being a threat to oneself or others?
Basically, yes, a danger to self or others, or in need of treatment, of protection, shall we say. So there's the doctrine of the police powers of the state to protect people, and then there's the idea of parens patriae, or the state as acting as a parent to take care of people who can't take care of themselves. But other than that, people have a right to refuse treatment, to be free in the community, and, you know, we live in a society that respects the rights of people to do lots of things that aren't necessarily in their best interest.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess that's the problem in many of these cases. I mean, how would this change a case like Kelly Thomas's case, where you have a man who is severely mentally ill, who's homeless, who's not on his medication, and who has engaged in some violent confrontations? And would this kind of law significantly help him get treatment?
Well, it could. One of the things that happens typically with it's called assisted outpatient treatment, which is kind of a euphemism, but AOT for short, is that a person will have a court-approved treatment plan that often involves being put on a team. Assertive community treatment, where there's a team of people who kind of wrap the services around the person and do things like make home visits and help them to take their medication. There's a doctor on the team, but there's a lot of it that really is about the case management and to try to, you know, provide outreach to people. And that's important to have those services. So if you think about it, I mean, psychiatric treatment and you know, things like medication for mental illness, they're not designed to solve everybody's problems in life. But if those problems and the inability to do very well and lead a normal life in the community are really related to untreated psychopathology, and the person can get treatment and also have the support around that individual to help them, then they might improve. And things like, you know, being homeless, that can be addressed directly, because housing and helping someone to get housing, perhaps to get into a subsidized housing unit, can be part of what AOT does.
Mm-hmm. And so, as I said earlier, Kendra's Law has been on the books for a while now. Has it been a success in New York?
Well, arguably, it has been a great success for the people who have received it, if you look at it from the point of view of what they were like before they participated in the treatment program and the court-mandated program, and after. So, if you look at it that way, and we did this evaluation in New York City, there's evidence that people had fewer hospitalizations, they were more likely to receive the treatment and take medicine, and those things are connected to a number of good outcomes. It didn't affect a whole lot of people, because not that many people actually meet the criteria and get put on the program. And the other thing I should say about New York is that one has to think about the services that were made available. And one direct or indirect result of Kendra's Law in New York was that it enhanced the capacity of the state to provide things like assertive community treatment. There are more of those slots made available because of a big appropriation of quite a lot of money initially to do that. And I think that's very important. If you think about AOT, something like Laura's Law or Kendra's Law, as just a solution all by itself, that's going to magically solve the problems of a public behavioral health care system that is fragmented and under-resourced and overburdened and doesn't work very well for people, that's probably a delusion in itself. It's like saying, you know, here's somebody in a wheelchair at the bottom of a staircase, and we're going to pass a law to make you get up the stairs, but we don't give you a ramp. And the ramp, you know, corresponds to treatment barriers that people have who suffer from schizophrenia and other illnesses. And so it has to be both of those things.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I hear from people, friends of mine who have seriously mentally ill relatives, and they're very frustrated with the laws as they are right now, because they can't force their loved one to take medication unless they've committed some horrible act or are about to commit a horrible act. And I guess this doesn't necessarily address that on the face of it, but hopefully with the wraparound services, it might help.
Well, yes. I mean, you can point to the civil commitment laws that require criteria such as dangerousness, and say that threshold is too low and it goes too far in protecting the rights of individuals who don't really know that they need treatment. On the other hand, part of this really has to do with access, as I say, and you know, the critics of outpatient commitment say, well, if this is about access, then go ahead and solve that problem. Invest in the system. Do what we know how to do. Provide evidence-based treatment and outreach to people. You don't need a court order to do that. That's their argument. So you know, it is controversial, and you know, basically it devolves to this collision between respect for the rights of people to be free to make their own decisions about medical treatment and the social responsibility that we feel to take care of people who can't take care of themselves. And so the proponents of outpatient commitment and things like Laura's Law will say, you know, we wouldn't let our elders with Alzheimer's disease wander around in the street, you know, with no help. That would be inhumane. Why do we say that it's okay to do that with young adults with schizophrenia? And the other side, you know, they say, well, wait, you know, I'm an adult. Yes, I have an illness. I'm doing the best I can to manage it. That's up to me. I'm not, you know, right now imminently dangerous. I'm not criminally accused. And, you know, I'm not legally incompetent. So on what basis does the state override my right to refuse treatment and force me into treatment? And so those two arguments kind of pass in the night. As the reality, most people who are put on these orders in New York and elsewhere start in the hospital and actually move from a more restrictive to a less restrictive alternative.
Jeffrey Swanson, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University School of Medicine, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, do you have a family member or someone else close to you who could benefit from Laura's Law, someone who refuses treatment that they may need? Tell us your story. You can call us at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave us a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play, or email pressplay@kcrw.com. Coming up, the U.S. is ahead of France for the first time in wine consumption. We'll find out why and what's happening with the wine industry here next on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. A votre santé, America, or should I say cheers. For the first time ever, the U.S. became the biggest wine market in the world last year. France, home of Bordeaux, Champagne, and Beaujolais, slid into second place. Quelle horreur. This is from a new report put out by the International Vine and Wine Organization. Thomas Matthews is executive editor of Wine Spectator magazine. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So what's going on here? How did the U.S. pull ahead in the wine wars?
Well, it's been a long and steady progress. The U.S. has actually been increasing its wine consumption now for 17 straight years.
Oh.
And France, on the other hand, has been declining. And finally, the lines crossed, and this year, 2013, we became number one at 329 million cases of wine consumed.
Okay, and why are people in France drinking less wine?
Well, there's a number of reasons there. First, there's a general demographic shift away as older people who were laborers who drank wine as their beverage of choice, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, are aging out of the market. Secondly, the younger generation has moved away from wine and more towards soft drinks and spirits. And finally, in recent years, the economic distress across all of Europe has decreased wine consumption as a whole.
Mm-hmm. And then people here in the U.S. are drinking more. Why is that?
Well, I again think it's complicated, but generally a very positive picture. Wine has become part of American lifestyle culture, just as the food industry and food revolution has exploded with celebrity chefs on TV and restaurants popping up everywhere. Wine has benefited from that, and it's now part of an aspirational lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. But per capita consumption of wine, France is still ahead of us.
Ahead of us. France is at about 46 liters a year, and we have grown from about 10 liters a year in 95 to just over 13 liters a year now. But we have such a population advantage that the result is greater total consumption.
So what does that mean in terms of a weekly amount? Is that like a bottle? The French drinking about a bottle and a half each a week?
Well, you know, you have to break out the population. In America, there are 40% of Americans who never drink any alcohol.
Oh, my gosh.
And we estimate
adults,
that,
you're talking
about. Yes. Yeah. And we estimate that of the adult consumers, about 10% drink about 80% of the wine consumed. So we're still a relatively small cohort of wine drinkers, but the young people, the millennials, are changing that. They have really embraced wine in a big way, and that's one of the big drivers.
Millennial Americans?
Yes.
And how come? Because they're just more foodie obsessed?
I think that's it. I mean, the baby boomers was the first big jump in wine consumption, but their parents didn't drink wine. They had to discover it on their own. The millennials are children of baby boomers, so they grew up with wine on the table and going out for dinner, and so for them it's totally natural.
Well, also, you can get good wines for a lot less these days.
The quality of wine has definitely increased. I mean, I grew up in the 70s when Boone's Farm and Gallo Hardy Burgundy were basically the wines of choice. Now, the millennial generation have got wines from all over the world, very fine wines at $8, $10, $15. I mean, it's amazing what the opportunities out there.
Okay, so we've been talking about consumption. What about production? Is France still at the top when it comes to producing wine?
Well, they haven't been for a while, actually, Madeline. Oh. Italy, it produces the most wine in the world. Spain has the most vineyards under vine. America is still relatively far behind. But nonetheless, about 75% of the wine we drink in America is produced in the U.S. So we drink American, too.
Californian, mainly?
That's about two-thirds, with about 10% from other states, Washington, Oregon, and New York being the leaders.
How do American wines play in France?
Zero. In fact, most of the wine-producing countries, apart from America, don't drink wines outside their country. We are a very broad-minded country.
Okay, now I've heard also that China is in the midst of a wine-drinking binge, that as it gets richer, more people there want to drink wine.
Yes, and in fact, China's growth from, say, 2005 to 2012 was faster than ours. But from a smaller base. And in last year, as you may recall, the Chinese government decided that the party was over. They put on a significant austerity measures, discouraging the government functions from serving wine and alcohol. And so they kind of stalled last year, and they are only at 187 million cases now. So far behind us and far behind France.
But do they drink their own wine, or do they drink other countries' wine?
The Chinese production is growing like crazy, and we think that they have a lot of potential for making fine wines, but right now it's still the fine wine market is largely imported. Unfortunately, they're also suffering from a huge assault of fraudulent wines, both on the high end and the low end. So that is also, as they become aware of that, has diminished their appetite for wine in general and foreign wines in particular.
Thomas Matthews, executive editor of Wine Spectator magazine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, this is the year of the commencement address disinvite, prominent speakers being unwelcomed at graduation. We'll talk about the importance, or the lack thereof, of commencement speeches after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The biggest issue that should be facing college students during their graduation ceremonies is which hand to shake with. But it seems like the choice of commencement speaker is making graduations increasingly contentious. On Monday, the director of the International Monetary Fund backed out of speaking at Smith College's graduation after protests from faculty and students. Condoleezza Rice recently met the same fate at Rutgers, and last Sunday, screenwriter Dustin Lance Black spoke to the Pasadena City College class of 2014, but only after they had re-invited him after uninviting him because of intimate photographs they'd found of him online. Well, this seems to be the year of the commencement speaker controversy. Is all this attention to the speaker missing the point of college graduation altogether? Dr. Robert Smith was president of Slippery Rock University in Pennsylvania for 10 years until 2012, and he decided to do away with commencement speeches at his university entirely, and he's here now. Welcome.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, before you did that, what was the selection process for choosing speakers?
Well, we would begin the process up to a year in advance. We'd seek input input from the various constituent groups, certainly the seniors who are going to be on stage, from our faculty, our alumni. We maintained a list of potential speakers from year to year, so we never really started from scratch. We had certain expectations. The first one was that whoever we had speak had an understanding of how to manage time, meaning, hey, this is 5 to 7 minutes. The second, that they had to have some connection with our students.
So wait, the first criterion was to just meet your time limit? That doesn't seem like a high...
Well, you know, it depends on the circumstances of where commencement is. You know, at one point I was in Kansas, and if you had commencement outdoors in late May or June, you'd have somewhat of an extraordinary event. In fact, arguably the shortest commencement speech ever was delivered by John Carlin, who was then governor of Kansas, to the University of Kansas graduates, and he looked out over these people sweltering in the heat, sitting in the football stadium, and he said, "Congratulations." Turned around and sat down.
And they were grateful. Well,
I always tried to remind our speakers, hey.
Right. Well,
here for other reasons.
Yeah. Well, it brings up the point, right? It brings up that point. But also, what is the point of a commencement speaker? And we've seen these controversies I just mentioned. And these are very high profile people, Christine Lagarde and Condoleezza Rice.
Yeah.
So who are the speakers actually, why are they brought in to address the students at these universities? Is it for the students or is it for something else?
I would hope it would be for the students. I mean, after all, this is their day. And that was very instrumental in our making the decision that we just do away with the speaker. That and a certain unreliability as to what was going to happen. And it just became, the care and feeding of them, it just became more and more difficult. And we finally just decided that, hey, let's refocus this. You know, I had one speaker, a distinguished journalist, award-winning journalist. He was standing by my side as we stood in the back of the stadium ready to go forward. The students were already there. And he's frantically writing on this scrap of paper, and I asked, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I'm writing my speech. I work better with deadlines." And I thought, this is still a highly symbolic, some would say sacred moment in an institution's history, and it's something these students are going to remember for themselves. Then let's focus it on them.
Well, I guess the idea or the ideal is to have a speech that they will remember and will inspire them to go forth and perhaps lead meaningful lives.
Yes, that would be the ideal. I'm not sure how many times that is really achieved. I mean, what you and I will see over the next several weeks are all of these articles identifying the top commencement speakers. They're not from the point of view of the students who are sitting in front of them. They're in the point of view of journalists and of other people who have made a decision that this was a great speech. But did that mean anything to the student?
Do you remember who spoke at your graduation?
I went through four. None. Not a one.
No, not.
And in fact, I would confess that I sat on the stage for over 60 others, and I can remember two or three, and not necessarily for the best of reasons.
All right. Dr. Robert Smith, former president of Slippery Rock University in Pennsylvania, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, he's probably right that parents and students don't care all that much about the graduation speaker. And yet, those speakers occasionally transcend the pomp and circumstance. People still talk about Steve Jobs' speech at Stanford and David Foster Wallace's address at Kenyon. And one of my favorites was a speech by author George Saunders that he gave to Syracuse University grads last year. And so I thought I'd play a little bit of it for you. This is from an adapted version we found on YouTube.
I'd say, as a goal in life, you could do worse than try to be kinder. In seventh grade, this new kid joined our class. In the interest of confidentiality, her name will be Ellen. Ellen was small, shy. She wore these blue cat's eye glasses that at the time only old ladies wore. When nervous, which was pretty much always, she had a habit of taking a strand of hair into her mouth and chewing on it. So she came to our school and our neighborhood and was mostly ignored, occasionally teased, "Your hair tastes good," that sort of thing. I could see this hurt her. I still remember the way she'd look after such an insult, eyes cast down, a little gut-kicked, as if having just been reminded of her place in things, she was trying as much as possible to disappear. After a while, she'd drift away, hair strands still in her mouth. Sometimes I'd see her hanging around alone in her front yard as if afraid to leave it. And then she moved. That was it. One day she was there, next day she wasn't. End of story. Now, why do I regret that? Why, 42 years later, am I still thinking about it? Relative to most of the other kids, I was actually pretty nice to her. I never said an unkind word to her. In fact, I sometimes even mildly defended her. But still, it bothers me. What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. Those moments when another human being was there in front of me, suffering, and I responded sensibly, reservedly, mildly. Or to look at it from the other end of the telescope, who in your life do you remember most fondly, with the most undeniable feelings of warmth? Those who were kindest to you, I bet. But kindness, it turns out, is hard. It starts out all rainbows and puppy dogs and expands to include, well, everything.
George Saunders, from his commencement address at Syracuse University last year. And joining me now in the studio, Warren Allnate for a preview.
That's the kind of commencement address that would keep the kids awake.
That's a terrific one, really, very touching,
very moving.
Yeah. And you should check out the whole thing on YouTube. It's great.
Indeed. We're going to be talking about the Veterans Administration and a real scandal that's going on there where veterans have had to wait so long sometimes just to get medical care that they have died while they were still on the waiting list before they ever got an appointment. Very disturbing, and the Congress is going to be looking into it tomorrow, the Senate, I should say. So we'll have sort of a preview of that and just how deep and serious the incompetence is. Maybe there's even corruption. Mm.
Okay, look forward to that at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, we're going to talk about space, a big problem with space junk. And now there's talk of building a space fence to keep track of it all. So that's coming up next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Could American astronauts get to the International Space Station using just a big trampoline? Well, that was the suggestion from Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin. Since the space shuttles were retired, the U.S. has depended on Russian rocket engines to reach the space station and send satellites into orbit. Yesterday, Rogozin announced Russia would no longer sell the U.S. government rocket engines for military satellites and would not allow the U.S. to use the International Space Station beyond the year 2020. That's when the current agreement expires. Well, back with us to talk about that and other space news is Jonathan McDowell. He's an astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, and he blogs about the space program at Jonathan's Space Report. Hi.
Hi there, Madeline.
Okay, so this trampoline comment, what's behind it?
Well, it just speaks to, I would say, the unprofessionalism of members of the Russian government at this moment. There's a lot of bluster. There's a lot of insults flying our way. The fact is that right now we are dependent on Russian spaceships to get to the space station, to get our astronauts up there. And, you know, given that, our taking personal financial sanctions against the guy who is the minister in charge of the Russian space program, it's not surprising that he's taking the opportunity to retaliate.
Mm-hmm. And is it just bluster, or do you think they'll actually go through with it?
The trampling comment seemed like bluster, but yesterday's press conference seems to be an official Russian government policy that really they're going to back off from the space station in 2020. They haven't yet said, for example, that American astronauts can't carry on getting rides to the station until then. So that would be a further ramping up, and that would actually break the current agreement. And so they may not want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's pretty clear that the merging of the United States and Russian space programs and astronautics industries that has been going on for 20 years is going at a full reverse now, and we're starting to have to disentangle all of the connections that are present.
Well, they do get a lot of money from the United States for sending our astronauts up there.
That's right. But that's the one thing they lose. They lose the hard Western currency if they pull out. But they still have the technology, if they want to put the money into it themselves, to fly their own space station, to get their own astronauts up. And they have very good rocket engines, which is why we've been buying them. In contrast, in the U.S., we do have our own rocket engines, and we will very soon, in the next few years, have ability to launch our own astronauts. So I think we'll be able to pursue our own space program just fine. But there's going to be a period of confusion, of difficulty, of delays while we make this adjustment.
Right. And then we have people lined up in the private sector who want to do this as well, including Elon Musk with SpaceX.
That's right. The critical test later this year of an emergency escape system for the Dragon capsule would put us on the track to launching American astronauts on the Dragon in the coming years. And so I think that's something to really look out for. And there are other human spaceflight, commercial spaceflight proposals. But the interesting thing is that they mostly use the Atlas V rocket to get into space, which is the one that has these Russian engines. Now, the Russians are saying that they'll still sell us engines for civilian use on these rockets. So those programs are still okay for now. But if things continue to deteriorate, that could get complicated.
Okay, so astronaut Rick Mastracchio gave a commencement speech for the graduating class of the University of Connecticut Engineering School from space. Let's hear a little bit of that.
I started out in the same place as you. Now, I've launched 3 times on the space shuttle. I helped build the International Space Station. I launched on a Russian Soyuz rocket, and now I'm living and working in low Earth orbit.
So he came back last night, and was it all good? I haven't heard anything to the contrary.
Yeah, the landing was perfect. Unlike last time where they came down in a blizzard and it was pretty unpleasant, it looked like blue skies in Kazakhstan. The next crew is going up in a few weeks. And so the operations of the International Space Station in this cooperative Russian, American, European, Japanese extravaganza are going on relatively unaffected by the politics for the time being.
So what do you think? Do you think that the astronauts are affected by the politics down on Earth and they're talking about it, the American and the Russian astronauts?
Well, you've got to wonder, don't you? I mean, What do they do on the off days? Do they gather in the Zvezda module and sort of have little political conversations? I think, you know, these people, they're engineers, they're military, they're very, very professional. I doubt that you know, tensions are high, but I'd also be surprised if they weren't talking about it.
Right. And this is the International Space Station, so it seems a little odd that Russia could prevent the United States from sending its astronauts up there.
Right. Well, the idea is that there's an international agreement that runs the station until 2020. And the trick is that you can't just abandon the station and leave it in space. You don't want it falling on someone's head. So the current plan was for the Russians to use the rocket engines to bring the station down in the South Pacific once all the astronauts had got off and get rid of it so that it wouldn't be space junk. The American hope was to get everybody to agree to keep running it longer because you've put so many billions of dollars into this that you want to keep using it. But the Russians are perfectly entitled not to sign on to that agreement. And then we get into an interesting situation.
You mentioned space junk or space debris, and there's talk of developing a space fence. what would that look like and how would that work?
Right. Well, the space fence is really to keep track of the junk. So it's like an early warning, an air traffic control system for space. And we actually did have one that was retired last year. It wasn't as sophisticated. And it's a really bad time for us not to know what's up in space, both because of rising tensions, but also because of increasing junk, because of the prevalence of tiny little satellites that are very hard to track with the current sensors. So the first step into clearing up space junk is to be able to know where it is, to be able to tell satellite operators, oh, there's something coming close to you, you better dodge. The next step is to actually get rid of it. And we're starting to have some ideas on how to do that, but I think that's really many years away.
How big a problem is it?
You know, it's bigger than you might think. And it's really very similar to what happened in the oceans, where we thought, oh, we can throw all kinds of junk into the oceans, they're huge. And it turns out, well, up to a point, they're not so huge. So in space, yeah, average, even tiny little pieces of space junk shrapnel are typically hundreds of miles apart, but they're moving at 18,000 miles an hour. And so they cover that kind of separation distance in less than a minute. So we are actually seeing collisions now, particularly over the North and South Pole, where space traffic is very dense. And so it's a real worry. Every now and again, the astronauts on the space station have to fire their engines and dodge one of these bullets. And you really don't want even a tiny piece of metal that's traveling at 18,000 miles an hour. That's going to punch a big hole in you.
All right, let's conclude with something a little nicer, and that is the astronaut Chris Hadfield doing a cover of David Bowie's Space Oddity. Here's part of that video of him singing the song on the International Space Station.
This is Major Tom to ground control. I've left forevermore, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way.
22 million hits on YouTube, but he only had the copyright to perform the song for 1 year, and that ended at midnight last night. And I guess the video is no longer available, at least on YouTube. Was this a big deal to the space community?
Oh, I think so. I mean, how can you? I love that song already.
Yeah.
But how can you not love it, him singing, you know, floating in a tin can as he floats in a tin can? and it just really sort of connected, I think, people's growing up with the reality of being in space. And it sort of made the reality of living in a space station very accessible, not just to people in the space community, but to the general public. So I think it was just brilliantly done, good spirit, you know, and I hope it becomes available again, because if you haven't seen it, you really should.
All right. Are you listening, David Bowie?
Exactly, yes. Please, David, let Chris have his YouTube back up.
Jonathan McDowell, astronomer at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, where he blogs about the space program at Jonathan's Space Report. Jonathan, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you.
Well, the Press Play oddity herself, Jolie Myers, is here.
I think that's the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me. You know, if David Bowie had been my commencement speaker, perhaps I actually would have shown up for the ceremony. I don't know about you, but I think that would have been
sang.
A heck of a speech. Or just
sang would be
you
great.
You know what? Or maybe people would have just liked me to hear me do a cover of David Bowie. So we did talk about commencement speeches today, and we asked whether you remembered your commencement speaker and what they said. Nikisha Hazel graduated from UC San Diego in 2007, and her commencement speaker was the late actor James Avery. That would be Dr. Phil from Fresh Prince, if any of you were wondering.
Oh my gosh, I was wondering.
She can't remember a word that he said, but she does remember how excited everyone was to hear Dr. Phil give their commencement speech. Jessica Rufino, her commencement speaker was Hamid Karzai back in 2005. So that's quite a bit different than Dr. Phil. And he talked about what else? War. It's probably kind of a downer as you
start your new life.
Uh-huh. George Caballo says that Art Buchwald was his commencement speaker, and he, George, actually remembers a quote from the speech. The only thing you need to remember about this speech is that I made you laugh, which is what I'm going to say from now on when I start this segment.
That's every perfect.
Day. See, I just made you laugh.
Did, and I'm
even if it was
that.
A courtesy laugh, which I think it was.
No, it really wasn't.
Okay, good. We don't have to parse that anymore. But from graduation to putting off college, we did a segment on gap years yesterday. Mike called in and said he's all for the idea of a gap year.
Most other countries do that. The U.S. seems to frown upon that. And I think it's a very valid time to travel, learn about the world, new people, culture, places, and define your character better than just skipping along through an educational system. Take some time off, breathe, smell the roses, hang out with the monks.
But Wiley commented on our website and said, I'm sorry, gap year just means rich kid to me. It's basically a fancy vacation, let's be real.
I know, nobody's proposing a gap year at the Burger King.
Right.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't need a consultant for that.
You don't, unless you get fired and then the federal government is your gap year consultant.
Jolie Myers, thank you for not taking a gap year and being here right this minute. And that's it for us. To the Point is next. Warren Olney, To the Point. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.